Welcome to Victor's Children, a podcast from so-called Canada, talking socialism from below. My name is David Canfield. I live with my partner and cat in Winnipeg, Manitoba, which is in Treaty 1 territory, the traditional territory of Anishinaabeg, Cree, Ojibwe, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and the homeland of the Métis Nation. All those of us in the Canadian state who aren't Indigenous need to commit ourselves to the struggle against settler colonialism. Victor's Children is a member of the Harbinger Media Network, a community working to promote left podcasts in Canada. Check out the list of Harbinger podcasts at harbingermedianetwork.com. Since October 2023, we've seen an unprecedented upsurge in activity and solidarity with Palestine within the U.S. I'm happy to be joined on this episode of Victor's Children by three people who've been deeply involved in the movement. I'd like to give you all my special thanks for making time for this conversation. Could you introduce yourselves to listeners, please?
Hi, everyone. My name is Iman Abed. I am the Director of Advocacy and Organizing at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Pronouns are she, her, hers. I am calling you all from Washington, D.C. today. I am a daughter of Palestine. My parents themselves are Palestinian. My mother grew up under occupation for 30 years, so occupation has bled into every facet of life for us for as long as I have ever known. And my grandparents are survivors of the Nakba. So I bring in all those sentiments as we kind of go into discussion here today.
I'm Sherry Wolf, she, her. I'm speaking to you from Brooklyn, New York. Long time Jewish anti-Zionist revolutionary socialist. I'm currently a member of Tempest Collective, JVP New York, NYC Labor for Palestine, and many, many other initiatives. I'm also the senior organizer at Rutgers Faculty, Grad, and Postdoc Union, where there's now a Faculty for Justice in Palestine that I collaborate with.
I'm Shireen Akram-Boshar. I'm a socialist activist in Tempest, an editor at Spectre Journal. I'm Arab American, and I'm a longtime Palestine solidarity activist. I was active in SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, for many years. I was actually just remembering when preparing for this podcast that the first National Students for Justice in Palestine conference in 2011 was in New York City, and a group of us walked from the conference at Columbia down to Occupy Wall Street, which says something, I think, about, you know, the growth of U.S.-based Palestine solidarity movement in conjunction with activist movements in this country. And, you know, we've had radicalizing movements since then too. And I've also been involved in broader Middle East solidarity and internationalist efforts since then as well.
I'll just mention as well that Sherry made a previous appearance on episode 7 of Victor's Children, an episode about should socialists take union staff jobs. And Shireen took part in a Tempest Palestine 101 event that was released as episode 35 of this podcast. So let's start the discussion with the question, what was the state of Palestine solidarity activity in the U.S. before October 2023, a little earlier in the year?
I would characterize the movement as having grown considerably for the over the past 20 to 25 years, particularly from the early 2000s through grassroots activism and the campus solidarity movement. I can talk a little bit more about Students for Justice in Palestine. So SJP was founded 30 years ago, but it began to spread to campuses across the country. And the movement as a whole, I think, was strengthened by, you know, the 2005 BDS call from Palestinian civil society organizations, and then from the first major Israeli assault on Gaza in 2008 and 2009, and each assault since 2012, 2014, and 2021, seeing, you know, more solidarity, more mass protests, and more serious activism and growth each time. In 2011, as I mentioned, SJP held its first national conference and has held one each year since, except maybe the first year of COVID. And the national conferences have really emphasized connecting to other anti-racist struggles to build coalitions on campus. And I think the campus work has helped build solidarity with Palestine among students across the country and made solidarity with Palestine automatic for many activists working on who are maybe working on other activist struggles previously. And that helped prime us for today's moment. But I also think it hasn't been, you know, just upwards or straightforward growth. I think, you know, the Trump presidency started immediately with, again, attacks on SJPs, for example, And right-wing university administrations were emboldened by Trump to ban SJPs, for example, at Fordham in New York. And many SJPs, I think, kind of went underground. And then on the other hand, in part because of fear and repression, I think the broader movement started looking more to solutions that I would say moved away from grassroots activism. So, for example, people started looking to electoral solutions or relying on Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar instead of continuing to build grassroots movement efforts and localized organizing or organizations. And of course, that wasn't just in the Palestine Solidarity Movement. It was a lot broader that saw the solution in the Trump moment is like electing Democrats and then putting Biden in office. And obviously the current moment has shown that that wasn't not a solution. I think that in 2021, like new life was kind of breathed into the solidarity movement here with the Unity Intifada in Palestine. And that was like the first really optimistic, united and grassroots movement across historic Palestine in decades. And it was a step forward for the movement here as well. And also came, you know, right after the 2020 Black Lives Matter revolt, which strengthened that, you know, impulse for multiracial organizing. And also, it also strengthened understandings of oppression and colonialism and racism. And I think that the 2020 BLM revolt made it more, even more automatic for perhaps another layer of Americans who are radicalizing to see, you know, who's oppressed and who's the oppressor in Palestine. And also, you know, it helped that Palestinians were putting forward a liberatory vision in 2021 as well, and clearly calling out settler colonialism and ethnic cleansing. I guess I'll just end by saying that today we're seeing a real return to collective and grassroots action being seen as automatic solutions rather than simple electoralism. Or, you know, by electoralism, I mean relying more on elections and in particular more on the Democrats than on grassroots mobilizing or localized activism.
Yeah, I think I would just add to that. The only thing that I would just, I think, add is I think all this time for the last couple of decades, we've watched two parallel structures forming, right? Like, I don't think it's necessarily that the movement may have taken, you know, this idea of like electoral organizing as a way of our liberation. I don't think that that's ever actually been a true idea of like how we've ever envisioned our liberation, but rather like, is this a possibility? Is this a tactic, an avenue we can use? And so for the last couple of years, we've seen that kind of flourish as a new parallel structure to all the organizing and the grassroots work that's been being done. And a lot of it has reflected kind of what's been forming across Palestinian civil society. I think we've watched for decades, and I mean, post-Nakba, post-Oslo, how workers' unions in Palestine have formed, how women's unions in Palestine have formed, how these like collective like liberation groups themselves have formed on the ground. And we've kind of here in the United States created these parallel structures, trying to find our ways and being able to kind of integrate the Palestinian vision all throughout the last couple of years. And I think it wasn't until just the last decade that we were able to find some avenue in politics and electoral spaces where our vision could potentially be seen, even though electoral politics to this day is still truly not believed to be as part of the movement, like what's going to help us achieve our liberation, but is another avenue and a tactic to use towards achieving that versus like being the ends itself. And I think that there's that's growing. There's this idea that more people are starting to believe in that right now, more people who are starting to kind of take that into consideration and all of that. So I think that's the only thing that I'll add to what Shireen just shared.
I guess since my lens goes back farther, it's worth me commenting on the fact that in the 80s, 90s, and early aughts, the composition of the movement in this country, in the United States, for Palestine was largely Jewish Marxists and Arab intellectuals. That's who was actively involved in organizing to the degree that was anything much happening in many places. And then you see a decisive shift out of the call for BDS, which think about, you know, Omar Barghouti, you know, who's part of crafting that call in the West Bank. What are some of his touchstones, his experience as a student when in the 1980s at Columbia University, some of the same touchstones with other people about, you know, the anti-apartheid movement around South Africa that informs the call for BDS, of Israel. And I think that also coincides with, you know, since 2005, a new generation of Arab and Muslim Americans, essentially Palestinian, but not just, growing up in this country, and unlike their parents who may have been immigrants or may have, you know, had other, you know, experiences that might have been silencing, not least of which the, you know, collapse of much of the American left, much of the global left, but a new generation kind of comes to the fore and takes over and becomes the leadership of the BDS movement and brings, you know, SJP, you know, into being. And it become, I was at that founding conference, I spoke at it on the myths of Zionism, actually marched with people in 2011, the one that Shireen references. And I think it's just been a completely different animal over this last decade, especially where people have, you know, chosen targets to boycott and divest from, had much more considered and strategic thought. And of course, in, you know, but it wasn't centralized, and it could often be come and go, or, you know, follow the vicissitudes of larger American politics in terms of the movement here in the States, and go into quiet moments or even moments of passivity, confusion, disillusionment, whatever. And I think that clearly that happened during the pandemic, with the exception of the explosion of organizing around the, you know, Black Lives Matter, in which Palestinian and Arab and Muslim students played an active role, and SJPs threw themselves into, to their credit. But really, October 7th has jolted everybody into an entirely different reality. Nothing like this has existed for Palestine in our lifetimes. Let's just acknowledge that. The last 5 months are unlike any other previous period. I believe that the default Zionism is gone, is dying, withering on the vine, you know, in this country in terms of consciousness. And it's forcing people, the gravity of the situation, or the horror of what we're seeing on our telephones, you know, on our cell phones, play out, has forced people who never saw themselves as activists, who never saw themselves as particularly getting involved, but refused to be bystanders in a moment like this, to get involved and start new structures of organizing. You know, Faculty for Justice in Palestine, you know, but like UAW, the Labor for Palestine, the fact that it's taking off in more cities, this has no precedent in my lifetime. Certainly not for a global struggle that is about the liberation of, you know, of an occupied people, which forces a conversation about U.S. imperialism and racism to a level and a depth that we've not seen. So I think that we are in a very, very different place today, tragically not strong enough yet to stop this genocide. But we are in a transformational moment. There's no doubt about it in the Palestine solidarity struggle globally and here in the United States at a level we've never seen before.
So, yes, Sherry, you've just bridged us to the important question of the movement that's emerged since October 7th. So I'm really interested in what you would all have to say about what you think its greatest strengths are and where the movement is at the moment.
I'm happy to take a jab at that first. I think in the last couple of... I'll just speak to like the last 2 to 3 years. I think one thing that we've been trying to do kind of education wise across the movement is bring attention to the ethnic cleansing and the mass displacement we were seeing happening in, you know, Sheikh Jarrah, as the Al-Kurd family kind of rose to fame in the last couple of years, kind of bringing attention to this displacement in East Jerusalem. And then we started to see the mass displacement that was happening in Masafariyata in the West Bank that I think was drawing attention again, just, what is it, in 2022? And I think when for years, families had been receiving these, in this court decision leading up to this moment that, you know, there are about to be dozens of families that were going to be displaced from their land in the West Bank. And so there was a lot of education that was being done to kind of like draw attention to the structures. What are we still facing? What does the ongoing Nakba still look like? As a part of the movement, we've been trying to build that, right? For 75 years leading up until last year, we were trying to construct this as a moment of like, this is not part of the past. This is an ongoing struggle that continues to be the same way. And I think that a lot of that language and the political education actually prepared us for the moment coming in October, where people were not, while that language was still very important, it actually helped set the context for what it is that we were talking about for many people. And I think even though there may have been people that have been kind of maybe didn't register super well, maybe they didn't understand the structures very well, I think come October 7th, people started to recognize, oh my gosh, this is an oppressed people. This is going to be really bad on them. Let's see, you know, and then watching that kind of happened within days of October 7th and what it meant for the Palestinian people, specifically in Gaza. And now watching, you know, ourselves kind of start using slightly different language, but actually starting to focus more on the Gaza Strip, kind of like brought this like major attention by the movement and kind of pulled everybody, at least like all hands on deck sort of an approach. We all have to focus on Gaza right now. We all have to focus on this idea that the military siege should have ended a long time ago. And then we knew that this was, could have been a potential product of, or excuse me, our conclusion of like the product itself. And I think that when the vision itself can be quite large, and it's great to have liberation struggles have like so much that encompass part of their, like that are part of their movement. I think in this moment right now, all eyes were on something. And I think as part of that, that makes it easier for people to start to hone in on an area and start to understand, okay, why is this certain place constructed the way it is? Why is the demolition and the atrocity that we're witnessing happening as badly as it is? Why are this many people? There are so many questions that people had in the beginning of all of this. Why are there this many people kind of placed into this one region, in this very small region? And so even if people weren't quite aware of it, this supposed complicated issue was no longer complicated. It started to become, it was starting to become deconstructed because it started to become a question of not politics, but a question of humanity. And I think that's really what moves people. We've seen that happen across different struggles, even with like the Black Lives Matter struggle, which the majority of people in this movement are younger people, right? Like we've watched how young people have come to rise, but this is not the first time they've heard of Palestine. Like, as you mentioned, Sherry, like the BLM movement did a great job at helping also fixate on like, we are part of a cross-movement struggle. These are part of our cross-movement demand. So for folks here, this wasn't some sort of like brand new awakening. It was a matter of like, oh my gosh, I've heard this happen before. And now I see why this is so bad, right? Like this can become so terrible. And I think that people were just awakened in that moment to, if this doesn't stop today, if this doesn't stop tomorrow, we're going to watch something much greater happen. And I think that's now what's unfolded over the course of the last couple of months. We are now calling this, we literally called this, you know, we were talking about the Gaza Strip in relation to a military siege. And then all of a sudden now we're talking about it in the context of genocide, right? And I don't mean this in a lighthearted sense, but like what an incredible transformation in language that we've had to like endure as a movement to even talk about our own people. I'll be very frank. I think as a Palestinian, it's a very hard thing to reckon with. We were talking about things in relation to ethnic cleansing. We were talking about things in mass displacement. We were talking about things in relation to occupation. Like those words are traumatizing enough, let alone to have to use the word mass murder, genocide, all of these things. And I mean, we're even coming to, you know, together here in this podcast about 5 months into this genocide beginning, and we have just now dealt with the flower massacre that we witnessed happen over the course of the last weekend. And people are still awakened. People are still coming out and coming out in the millions across the world. I mean, we just witnessed the global strike for Palestine just yesterday. And I think, you know, I think that there is this want to not stop until we actually see this end. I think because it's so flat in our faces, whether or not, you know, and I feel like we can't even talk about the solidarity movement without talking about the realities of repression. I think the reason behind why it ebbs and flows is because just as like any other cross movement that gains its own traction, that gains its own popularity, oftentimes Western colonial structures or imperialist structures in general want to suppress that. And I think that there are these avenues and these moments in time throughout the course of the last few decades that has happened, and it's even happening now. But I think people have come out so far, and you know, and the numbers are so much greater than the repression can even try to suppress, that it's been able to still gain this much traction. And I think it's because, again, it's an issue of morality. It touches people's hearts and minds. And people also believe that they have a role to play. I mean, everybody, not just here in the United States, but just across all countries, have now questioned their governing authorities. What role does my governing authority have in this moment? What have they done to aid this genocide? What have they done to continue funding this military system? What are they doing? And how do I, as a taxpayer, how do I, as an active citizen, participate in this too? The question is being asked every day by this movement. And I think like people really want to see it end. And I've been moved by it the last couple of months. And it's also amazing to me that even just yesterday, having attended a demonstration outside the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., and literally standing in the path of where Aaron Bushnell took his life for the sake of the Palestinian movement, there were over 1,000 people who came up. That's unheard of. Like to happen 5 months after people have already been out in the streets for day in, day out. And it's like, to me, it's like, how could you not be moved by this? Clearly, there's something dissonant between the people and their governing authorities. Clearly, there's something happening here. But the people are not giving up. And I think that's a really beautiful thing.
Yeah, it's hard to follow that, Iman. I think that, as both Iman and Sherry said, the movement that's emerged since October 7th has, you know, surpassed our expectations and pushed solidarity with Palestine much farther than ever before. And first and foremost, as Iman alluded to, it managed to push beyond the extreme moment of repression after October 7th, where, you know, Islamophobia, silencing and repression was really at its height. Remembering back, you know, that was a really scary moment, which felt like the post 9/11 moment. It felt as if, you know, activism was going to be squashed and not able to coalesce at all. And initial protests were badly smeared and demonized. And there was a quick move to, you know, ban SJPs, which DeSantis did across Florida, for example, and in other places as well. And they were smeared nationally. And it seemed like the narrative would be shifted towards a pro-Israel one for a long time. That was the sentiment right after. But, you know, the movement pretty soon managed to emerge despite that repression into something, you know, more powerful than it's ever been before. Of course, sort of in proportion to the absolutely dire situation of genocide and extermination in Gaza. I guess echoing Iman, I think some of the strengths of the movement are that it now puts forward a knee-jerk automatic solidarity with the oppressed and a framework and language that's moved beyond that of like international law or rights-based framework to instead, you know, siding with the oppressed and colonized, anti-racist language and an understanding of colonialism and support for resistance in the face of colonialism and in the face of the horrific conditions Gazans are in. In that way, I would say it's a similar strength as the Unity Intifada in Palestine in 2021, again, building off the Black Lives Matter movement of 2020, turning to a framework that's much more left-wing rather than the rights-based framework that was predominant over the past few decades. And along with that, I would say today's movement has put forward the understanding, again, echoing Iman, of the U.S. and in particular Biden's complicity in the genocide. The idea that, you know, the U.S. and its head of state, whether Democrat or Republican, are willing and eager to fund Israeli atrocities, but not the education and healthcare and housing needs in this country has become popularized. I've seen people saying that across the country. And that's really an understanding. That goes along with understandings of sort of the problems with capitalism in this country and how deep the inequality is here, even as we subsidize settler colonialism, stealing Palestinians' land. So that popularized notion is also a step forward. And I would say, you know, possibly the biggest strength of the movement is its rejection of Biden. You know, millions of people are seeing Biden as responsible for the continuation of the genocide and as an equal partner in the genocide, which, of course, I would say is accurate. You know, for over 5 months, he ridiculed the idea of a ceasefire. He could have threatened to withhold aid to Israel, but instead he bombed Yemen for making things difficult for Israel. And the movement has seen that clearly. And recently, the rejection of Biden has shown up in Michigan's campaign to vote uncommitted in the primaries. So organizers were aiming for 10,000 uncommitted votes in the primary last week, but instead there were over 100,000, which is also huge, I think. I think this is the first time we've seen a significant protest vote in decades, at least. Uncommitted came second after Biden before, I think it was 13% of the vote. And now activists are seeking to replicate that effort in other states. I'm sure Michigan's will be the most effective of them, of course, given its Arab American population. But it's really hopeful that this is happening and spreading. And I think, you know, the rejection of Biden is an opening for those of us on the far left, to argue against electoralism as a solution and against the logic of lesser evilism. And put forward more of an analysis of the two-party system and of the Democrats as a fundamentally capitalist and pro-Israel party. And I think making those arguments is easier than ever, even though some people, I think, may still be in the mindset of, you know, we just need to teach the Democrats a lesson by withholding our votes this time, and then they'll avoid being complicit in genocide next time. But yeah, another strength, as I sort of mentioned before, is understanding mass protest and continued civil disobedience as necessary, rather than simply relying on politicians for solutions. So we've seen, you know, dozens of protests that have blocked major bridges and highways. We've seen Nancy Pelosi heckled and interrupted several times, and Biden interrupted and protested on his campaign stops and TV appearances. And these are so necessary in sort of bringing back a culture of dissent in this country, I think, and normalizing protest and civil disobedience. I think unfortunately, in moments of backlash, often the wrong lessons have been learned. So like after the short-lived anti-war movement against the Iraq War, some people took away from it that mass protest doesn't work. And some people took away that a similar lesson, I think, from the Black Lives Matter movement, from its defeat, from the backlash that's emerged since it. But that's not correct. And thankfully, in this moment, people are, you know, taking to the streets again and understanding that is needed in common sense. The problem with the anti-war movement in 2003 wasn't that mass protests aren't effective. It was that it didn't last long enough. They collapsed into campaigning for a Democrat, and, you know, which history shows generally sucks the energy out of movements. And with the backlash to Black Lives Matter, it wasn't that mass protests aren't effective. Obviously, the 2020 revolt changed consciousness in the U.S. and globally. But the problem was a lack of sustained organizing and organizations coming out of it, and lack of organizing independent from NGOs, for example. And I think luckily, you know, those wrong lessons haven't prevented protest in this current moment.
Just to say something about the highlights for me, at least, because everybody has spoken quite eloquently here about the breadth and the depth of the solidarity explosion, as well as its persistence, which is just unprecedented in my political experience. We're nearly 150 days in, and these fuckers can't go anywhere and show up anywhere without being interrupted, as they should be dogged, and then mass protests continue to erupt. But the two highlights I want to put out there that will stick with me so far, so many, I mean, a million images, but in terms of the resistance and the protests, I have to say that I participated in the planning and the execution of the Grand Central Station occupation and shutdown by JVP New York in October, which started a wave of such occupations and mass disruptions. Initially by Jewish Voice for Peace in New York, and then Oakland, the Bay Area, of course, you know, will always one up you, and they just go throw their car keys off the bridge and just block the fucker and pace themselves down, because the Bay Area will live on as the Bay Area. So props to them. But I think occupying and shutting down the transit hub for the economic hub of the empire on a Friday during rush hour, with literally thousands of people, led by and majority of whom were Jewish New Yorkers in a city that is understood to be, rightly so, the capital of sort of Jewish US. I mean, 1.5 million Jews live here, and I live for the day when that no longer matters who you are in terms of your position in all of this. But given the fact that Israel so desperately needs to conflate its, you know, ethno-nationalism with, you know, Judaism, it matters that this was happen the way it did. And it was just a beautiful action. And as somebody who spent hours in there, it was also quite notable seeing the responses of people passing through the station before it was entirely shut down, and how much people were with us. And the people who weren't were mortified and isolated and terrified because of our numbers. And you can see them. And we ushered them quickly away. Otherwise, they would have been beaten to a pulp, to be honest, by some folks. But none of the organizers. But I think some people were enraged. And the other thing, I think, in some ways, in a simple way, was yesterday. It was freezing cold in New York and pouring rain the entire day. And thousands of people poured into the streets, so disgusted and horrified that we have reached the moment of 5 months you know, the flower massacre just 2 days before, I think, even put this protest on people's radar screen. And importantly, and it's a milestone here, organized labor starting to come out in contingents as organized labor, NYC Workers for Palestine, Librarians and Archivists for Palestine, UAW for Palestine, faculty from here, there, and the other place for Palestine. This is what is showing up. And so we're seeing, in some ways, in the midst of a pouring rain, a pivot to organizing and structuring ourselves for the long term, not just stopping this genocide, but actually what's going to, the next phase in this, of what's going to come next and how we're going to fight, you know, to end this occupation and to amplify the demands of our comrades on the ground in Palestine. So I think those are hugely important milestones and high points for me.
Thanks to all of you for speaking so eloquently about the strengths of the movement. I'd like to now take us to the question of things that might stand out for you as things that are missing or problems within the movement that need to be addressed in order for the movement to grow in strength, because it's important when we want to build the movement to actually be able to name, to identify those kinds of issues and address them constructively. So are there any that you'd like to highlight?
Yes. maybe I'll kick it off, and I hope my sisters here come on in. But to be honest, the absence of space for strategic thinking and collectively strategizing what we're doing as a movement is, I see, is the biggest, greatest weakness. And it's not unimaginable why, because many of the formations have come about just either been born in just the last few months or, you know, preceded the last few months, but we don't have many examples of democratic organizing, you know, spaces in this country. There is, on top of that, let's face it, the genuine, very real and very serious security concerns that people have. And so people are not likely to want to be in spaces, either in person or on Zoom or what have you, where they can think aloud in a place where they could be doxxed, or they could, you know, lose a job, or they could have, you know, family members harmed by what they say or do or whatever. And so there's those concerns. So I think a kind of both legit concern, security culture, and sometimes I think that borders into a place that's unhelpful and cuts against a more democratic, inclusive conversation. But the just sheer absence of strategic conversations happening across the various movement groups and even within movement groups, I think is a serious, serious flaw that has to be discussed, confronted, and addressed if we are to be able to make a decisive move forward, because we have to be able to sit in rooms, virtual and otherwise, and have honest conversations with each other about what's working and what's not. And I think that the horror and the urgency of the situation forces people to be in the streets, but that's not, months in, a substitute for also, you know, wedding that to building democratic structures and decision-making and figuring out how to have strategic discussions and use the education meetings that are just proliferating and beautiful and brilliant and wonderful to help inform the strategic thinking of a movement. And that is, I think it's deepest flaw in this moment right now, absence of democratic strategic planning structures that we are, and sometimes it is not willful in any way. I don't think that that's because people don't want democratic strategy. I think that people don't know how necessarily. People are concerned about what that looks like. And then there are a minority of people, and I believe they are a small minority of people, but they are there, who in whose interest is not to have broad democratic conversations, because that would require having an honest political discussion about what struggles from below can achieve, what the electoral prospects really are and are not, and who our allies are globally and who they are not, and who are not our allies globally. And those conversations are simply not happening. And I think that that's something that the revolutionary left, that organizations like Tempest Collective and others, I think see as important to insert ourselves into.
Shireen, Iman, either of you have anything you'd like to add on that question?
Yeah, I think that in order to even talk about the challenges, I do want to figure out how movement is such a broadly defined term. And so when we talk about movement, what movement means to me could be slightly different than what it means to even like Shireen or Sherry. I think that I want to acknowledge that when I think of movement, I think about, even the Palestinian movement has different tiers of what it means to be a, you know, movement partner. You have the people who are directly impacted. So that's Palestinians themselves in this moment. So that's a sphere of its own, as there are organizations that are Palestinian, whether they're predominantly Palestinian, Palestinian-led, whatever they are, that are working directly on like how Palestinians are being impacted. You have your allies, who are people who are not maybe directly impacted, but want to stand up in support of the struggle. And I also separate out cross-movement partners. So these are people who may have like parallel structures and solidarity movements that happen. So I wouldn't necessarily constitute them as allies, but they are people that also have and are living under an oppressive structure in some way and have like their own set of demands that, you know, are all collectively building towards a shared liberation. I think to me, in any movement, this is something that I truly believe at the core of my heart for any structural like development we're trying to make inside these movements, demands towards liberation and what liberation looks like should always be informed by the directly impacted. I think so in this case, when it comes to Palestinians and we're talking about the future of Palestine, those decisions and those demands and the vision needs to be created for by the Palestinians themselves. Like I am a true believer of that, just as I was in any other form or am in any other form of struggle. I think that if we're talking about Black liberation, that should be informed by Black people in the West or across the globe. Same with Indigenous and all these other sorts of struggles. I think that we as allies, when we step into those spaces, should be informed by those demands. How do we step in and how do we support achieving those sorts of things that are coming out of that? So I want to acknowledge that when it comes to that, that's something that I want to firmly consider. So, you know, I don't necessarily know actually if I agreed with everything you shared, Sherry, but I think that's okay. I think that I think in different spaces, we're having those conversations in the movement about what does it actually mean to move forward? Where are our challenges and how do we overcome them? And sometimes there have to be like affinity squares that form as well. Like how do we define, based on our identities and where are we forming and how we're choosing to align, how do we want to move forward and figure out what is it that our own movement and our own communities kind of bring to this overall like larger movement space? And I think additionally, I want to acknowledge a challenge. I think sometimes we're so fixated on ourselves and like how we struggle because of sometimes there's every marginalized community has its own issues. Like when it comes to figuring out how to identify its liberation and all these sorts of things in different moments of time. So it's not particular to the Palestinian movement in any way. But I do think that there's something to be said about the outside structures that cause those sorts of things to come to a collapse. And like, I think first, we were talking a little bit earlier about like electoral organizing and those sorts of things. Like, I don't want to undermine the Zionist pro-Israeli lobbying structures that really get in the way of like being able to help us achieve the progress that we need. I mean, the reality is that Zionism itself has shown up in every facet of American life, every facet. And I think like, I don't want to undermine the fact that there is this very powerful structure that we haven't had the ability to undermine just yet. We don't have the power ourselves in the movement to be able to do that. And I think that's really difficult. It's why we're 5 months into this genocide and we haven't been able to stop it from happening. We don't, our voices are growing and our voices and our shared sentiments are growing, but it hasn't yet necessarily gotten to the point. And I'm not saying we have to equate to where those Zionist voices and those structures are, but I do think that there's something to be said about we haven't been able to demolish them yet. And I think it's impossible. It's not going to happen in 5 months. That's just absolutely impossible. But I think there's something for us to continue focusing on the external that I think has always been kind of this impediment to why we haven't seen a liberated Palestine just yet. And I think that there's a reality to figuring out how do we confront that and how do we deconstruct that altogether? And what are the different pieces? So what do our Jewish allies do? What do our Palestinian allies do? What do our Black allies do? Indigenous allies? What are the different pieces we all hold? And like, how do we all kind of serve in a different lane, but all kind of working towards the same sorts of vision and demands and this liberation struggle and figure out what is it that we're all actually trying to get done together? I think we're figuring that out, but I think it's still a challenge.
Yeah, I was definitely going to echo what Sherry said in terms of coalition spaces and places to debate. I think that, you know, in some cities or states, there are strong coalitions. For example, we've heard a lot about Vermont and their success in having a broad coalition of different organizations. But I think in more places, there's a lack of cross-organizational coalitions, and as Sherry said, a lack of spaces for debate around strategy. And I think the movement has pushed groups, some groups, to start organizing on the ground and not just online, some of them in a really dynamic way for the first time. But there's still, you know, maybe because of the years of COVID, like a feeling of being more used to organizing online rather than talking things out, or even to add to what Sherry said, there's often a division between the different organizations, and they're not being brought to the same room. So that, for example, in New York City, there's a protest happening by one organization in one location, and the next day another organization, instead of being brought together and figuring out how to bring the most people together through a united action, for example. And another weakness, I think, as I mentioned, there's a knee-jerk solidarity with the oppressed this time around, which is a major step forward. But in some instances, we've seen, you know, praise for other states, which are seen as an alternative to the U.S. or as a potential force that can oppose the U.S. So some, you know, praise or apologeticism for Iran or China or South Africa, seeing South Africa as a model state instead of all three of them as deeply problematic states with authoritarian tendencies and, you know, they're actually capitalist and not true alternatives, or not, you know, a potential opposition that could bring a solution to U.S. imperialism. And I think that means something for the movement that we're trying to build, seeing ourselves and people's movements globally as the way forward, and not looking to states. And, you know, what does it mean for our movement if we see connecting Palestinian liberation to other struggles for liberation as key, which I think it is, if we're supporting the states oppressing them? So, for example, in the case of Iran, Iran had an uprising in 2021 against the regime, and we want to be supporting the people in that movement. Or in the case of Syria, you know, I think the current movement could have more of an analysis of how the Assad regime, you know, has used rhetoric that's anti-imperialist or anti-US and Israel, but in fact has been part of the problem and oppressing Palestinians and oppressing its own people, as well as, of course, the Jordanian regime, the Egyptian regime, which have a hand in or are directly collaborating with Israel today.
Thank you all for your thoughts on that. Anything you'd like to say then about how people who want to build a more powerful movement can address some of these weaknesses in order to help move us forward?
Sure. For one, I think what is starting, at least here in New York, among some of the labor folks and some other folks, is having meetings to discuss strategies of, you know, how do we instrumentalize the demands coming out of Palestine for divestment and getting, you know, and blocking the war machine from sending its, you know, armaments, you know, to Israel to be used against Palestinians and others. I think discussion about, you know, how we not just plan the next action, but how we structure ourselves to organize for a longer term fight, and understand this as the Palestinians have for some now 76 years, I guess, going on, that this is not simply going to be, you know, won in a year or months or something like this. This is a longer term battle, and we have to situate ourselves with a strategy that has both a short term, medium term, and long term goals. So I think those conversations are in some ways at the very primitive level of happening within organizations. I don't yet see evidence of them existing across organizations, although big ups to SJPs for in November of 2023, seeing the moment for what it is and creating sort of much more centralized national structures so that they're, you know, initiating things together and speaking together and coordinating much better. I think the students in that regard are ahead of their elders, if you will. Universities also organize people in ways that other places don't, but that is just simply a fact that we should acknowledge. So I think that creating these spaces, and I think deepening, I think we need to, in labor, and I noticed this even in conversations at planning meetings for yesterday's march, where the labor contingent was several hundred, there needs to be an explicit understanding that labor is not one constituency among many coming to the fore in this solidarity, that when we talk about shutting things down, there are groups of people who are uniquely situated to do that in this country. And what would it look like for transit or communication with some other groupings of workers to literally, you know, call strikes or interruptions or job actions or doing that kind of thing? And so having conversations with people at work, and not just the people who are already leftists and already convinced, but the broad swath of people who are looking at Gaza and horrified and don't have yet a set of politics, an analysis or a strategy or an organization to fit that horror into. And I think seeing people who people work with as potential activists and organizers as well, and creating bridges in to this long-term struggle. It doesn't mean that people are going to every week for the rest of their lives be in meetings. It means that people are going to take some action and maybe incorporate the liberation of Palestine into their organizing and resistance work that they are beginning to adopt within their workplaces and communities already. So this is what I think needs to happen. This is what I see, you know, glimmers of hope of, but it's not explicit, it's not yet intentional, and it's not yet widespread.
Iman, anything you'd like to say?
Yeah, I feel like I just had a conversation with someone this past week, specifically with a group of allies and who we had met with to talk about kind of just like coming out of like the Michigan uncommitted vote and all this like energy that had come out of electoral organizing. People are like, well, why the heck are we using this as a tactic? Like, this isn't going to help us, all these sorts of things. Right. And I think that we become so fixated on like the oftentimes as movement partners and whatnot. I think it's just like, it's just people in general. Like, we oftentimes are quickest to critique ourselves, quickest to provide like this sort of criticism of the movement and where we haven't necessarily done a good job, and or, you know, already emphasizing that this tactic isn't going to work out, or it is. And I mean, I think the reality is we just have to push for something and try, right? Like, we have to push for something and try in every avenue that we possibly can. And I think the reality is I think we've tried so many different tactics, like, right? Like, I think we've touched on the mobilizations that have happened, the protests that continue happening. Like, it's important to be out in the streets. That cannot change. Although the reality is that people also get exhausted. People really do get fatigued. And the reality is we have to organize in different places. And so I think coalition spaces are an incredible, incredible place to formulate those thoughts, have those strategy discussions and all of that. And like also have a combination. There are all these like national organizations. I mean, I am someone who represents one of them, but there are also these incredible grassroots organizations all across different localities who have either been reignited, structured themselves out newly in the last couple of months, or just like are tapping in. People, you know, individuals are starting to tap into the existing structures in their own localities to be able to kind of like have this incredibly engaged constituency. And like the reality is they're like, local organizing is the best space to be organizing in, because at the end of the day, it's that local organizing infrastructure that we build that can actually stop this sort of system that we're trying to demolish from continuing to happen. And I think there are people who are trying to focus in on now. And I think that our top demand as a movement remains to be ceasefire. Until we see ceasefire happen, we cannot stop asking for it. I mean, like, for God's sake, it's 5 months. The fact that we're still calling for it is unbelievable. But the reality is, I think people are finally starting to see that ceasefire cannot even be permanent if we continue providing aid to Israel. Like, we just can't see our own, this cannot continue, because it's going to happen in some other space. It'll happen in another region, like part of the Palestinian state. Like, it's just going to happen somewhere else if this doesn't get put to an end. And so people are starting to have those very detailed conversations. Okay, what sorts of investments is my city making? What sorts of commitments are my members of Congress or my local, you know, city council members making on an everyday basis? What are the sorts of structures that exist in my own organization? What are like I don't want to dismiss the Not on Our Dime campaign, which was a campaign that came out of New York to target charitable-based status organizations, and acknowledging that there are organizations in our own cities who are funding settlements. That's unbelievable. Like, the fact that that exists here in the United States is just unreal. But people are fixated on it. People are now asking themselves, okay, like, New York has these sorts of things. Does my other state or city have this too? And the reality is oftentimes this information is actually kept from being, like, it's non-transparent for a reason. It's intentionally confusing to find. It's intentionally kept from the public because it's so messy. And like, as people start to become more aware of it, they're going to be like, what the heck? Like, why is this even happening here? But I think people are starting to actually invest their time in these sorts of divestment campaigns. These are very strong campaigns that at the end of the day actually leverage us beyond just the ceasefire demand and get us to the point of ending U.S. military funding to Israel. Like, that is the reality. And there are structures and pillars that uphold these systems. And they're not just the decisions that get made at the top. There are decisions that get made in our everyday cities that are actually getting us to this point. And if we don't question what's happening in those cities, it's never going to stop at the top. And I think that people are finally feeling ignited enough to develop and actually sustain that energy in those spaces to be able to do it. And the reality is every movement's going to have a moment where it dies out. Every moment, like, people are going to step back, people are going to be tired. And this is not because the Palestinian demands are bleak. It's not because the vision isn't understood. No, it's just the reality of any sort of movement. Like, we watch this happen all the time. Again, movements ebb and flow. They don't always look the same. The energy isn't always the same. But the reality is, if we form these structures right now while the energy is still high, we can also find ways for people to plug in and be able to actually participate in this long-term commitment. I mean, we are an organization that is committed to ending U.S. military funding. The best way to help people understand that is, like, it's not going to happen tomorrow. It may not even happen in 20 years. But the reality is we can be working every single day to commit to deconstructing these structures. But it has to be done in a way that's strategic, that we do together, and we figure out exactly what avenues and lanes are we each in to make sure that that happens. Because if we feel like we are trying to do everything all at once, it's never going to get us towards our liberation. But there are different facets, and I really look forward to seeing what our movement is capable of, because I do truly believe it has actually won in ways that have been so incredible. And I think, like, I don't want to dismiss that as we end this, you know, this recording, but I'm just truly amazed by the people power and what they've been capable of doing in this moment.
Any last thoughts about what people in the U.S. who want to act in solidarity with Palestine should do in the months ahead?
Yeah, there's going to be a siren song to put everything aside. Eventually, the actual bombs will stop dropping, and to demobilize this phase and to pivot towards the elections, getting Biden elected. So on one level, I think that that would be a great disservice, not only the Palestinian people, but to ourselves. I personally don't give a shit who people vote for or whether they vote or whatever. The reality is neither the party arming, funding, and supporting genocide nor the out-and-out fascists are going to be a solution of whoever wins in the election in 2024. That is not going to be decisive. What's going to be decisive is what we do, as we saw when Trump won the election in 2016. If people had not mobilized from jump, to oppose the Muslim ban, to go to the airports, the DACA mobilizations, all of the rest of that. If that hadn't had the Women's March from day one, if these kinds of mobilizations hadn't happened, things would have been far worse. We all know it. And, you know, our responses to, you know, the rising fascism on the ground is what has, you know, made the difference, certainly after Charlottesville and all the rest. I think we have to start thinking through and learning from what we've just lived through, that we need to actually stay organized and mobilized for divestment, for disarming Israel, for it does a job discrediting itself. So we don't have to discredit it. So what we need to do is take the organized logical ramifications from its discrediting and have, you know, Israel be completely disarmed, disfunded, defunded, and no longer subsidized by the U.S. federal government and all the various institutions, whether it's the AFT or, you know, the AFL-CIO or any of the places that we work, TIA, you know, our pension funds, what have you. That's the work that we need to stick with, because that's what's going to influence whoever is in office. That's what's going to influence policy and the direction of things. In my opinion. And I think it would be horrible if we have a pivot towards a campaigning for a political party and an individual that people simply don't even agree with on the central feature that it's gotten immobilized in the first place, that it's not going to be our saving grace. That's not how we're going to make any progress for Palestine or any progress domestically, in my opinion. So I think the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement coming out of a ceasefire. I mean, people talk about ceasefire as being the floor. Well, we are way, way beneath the sub-basement right now, so we haven't reached the floor. So I absolutely agree with Iman. Ceasefire remains at the forefront. But we all know at some point the shooting will stop, because they'll have destroyed every goddamn building in that place. And now, you know, and we have to move to fight to keep Cousins alive and fight for a political and human future for the Palestinian people.
Yeah. So in terms of what people in the U.S. who want to act in solidarity with Palestine should do in the months ahead, I think, as you've both said, what people are doing now already, continuing to do that, as shown by yesterday's Day of Action for Rafah, and in light of the Flower Massacre, you know, working to stop the full-scale destruction and invasion of Rafah and the starvation of the northern, or really the entirety of Gaza, and working to stop the possibility of the forced transfer of the 2+ million people who are still in Gaza. So continuing to work, as you've both said, for a ceasefire and then deepening the longer term organizing. And then I'll go back to what I mentioned before. I think that our across the left that's in solidarity with Palestine, continuing to deepen and study the connections to other struggles, particularly including the Black Lives Matter struggle, for example, and other anti-racist struggles, but also particularly studying other struggles in the Middle East region, because I think opposing the regimes in the region is key to pushing back against the long process of normalization, which has gone on across the region. And pushing back against those regimes is key to shifting the status quo that's allowed for, you know, an iron hand and authoritarianism and normalization across the region, and that makes it easier for Israel to do what it wants across in Palestine. And I also just wanted to add, continuing to push back against Islamophobia, putting our own voices forward. You know, the New York Times, for example, the coverage has just been horrific. It's put forward Islamophobic nonsense since day one, and that's been the vast majority of its coverage. It should have been forced to apologize for its Islamophobic story that has been revealed by like The Intercept and others to be largely, fabrication. And I think Islamophobia has been, you know, in this country, we've started to really, over the past decade or so, push back against anti-Black racism, which has been so important. But I think there hasn't been enough against Islamophobia, because it's, you know, Islamophobia has been so effective for the over two decades of the war on terror in allowing us to ignore mass slaughter across the region, across the Middle East, and sort of, I think it helped enable the start of like increasing repression and mass slaughter in Gaza as well. So pushing back against Islamophobia, I think, goes hand in hand with, you know, pushing against the repression of our movement in the current moment.
Yeah, I think I want to echo Sherry's, the focus on BDS is so critical. I think like people do get hurt where we can actually shift money. Like that is a tactic that we should never undermine. The reality is that's literally what's driving this whole damn conflict, right? Like the reality is that there's economic and like objectives that are being reached at here. Like not to say that like literally this is why the United States gets invested in anything, right? Like this is why we know that. And I think like, let's not undermine the fact that we also have like this, like we live in a capitalistic structure. We have the authority to choose where we and how we choose to invest our own money and our pay. And I think like that's a reality that we don't want to undermine that. And I think that if we could even focus in on like 1 to 2 targets very, very well, I think there's a lot that could be done extremely positively and can actually make a shift there. I think the other piece that I would just add as well is I think that it's very easy to get bogged down in politics and kind of dismiss it and remove it from like strategy and remove it from our everyday attention. And I think the reality is that's literally what our elected officials and the administration, specifically the White House administration, are betting on, is that, oh, okay, like we can get people off our backs. Like we can get them to stop questioning or calling our offices and, you know, bombarding us at our, at these events that we're trying to host. And it's like, the reality is that these are the most, like, it's, you know, what, 48 hours ago, we hear that the United States is going to airdrop aid into Gaza. Like that's unbelievable, as the president has also literally overcome authorization from Congress to send ammunition and like additional bombs to Israel in the midst of this moment. Like we're not even talking about prior to October, I'm talking about in the last 5 months, the amount of times that the president has done that. And like the reality is that you're literally not even able to get through the walls you have helped build up And so now you have to get to this point of airdropping aid, that how in the world can we even make promises to people will not get shot at as they're trying to get that aid? Like, this is just this is an unbelievable reality. And to think that he was capable, even in just, again, the last 48 hours to make a statement like that, what is it, 4 days now before his State of the Union, as a reminder to people and like as a way, like, oh, he's doing something great. Like, right. But it's like people are actually much smarter than that and have already been able to see past it, saying like, we see your hypocrisy, we see your and why people are critical, and it's not working. And I think that's great. And that's because people keep their attention on it and we keep watching how hypocritical this administration is, how damaging this administration is. And now people are starting to also say things like, Israel is not the only one capable of committing this genocide. The United States has also been committing this genocide. And I think I can't even understand how we're going to use legal structures in the next couple of months, if not the next couple of years, to hold the United States, accountable in this moment. And I hate that things have to happen after the fact, but the reality is it's just sometimes what happens. And so I think that as long as we keep our attention on it as a movement, even if it's not where we want to invest our time, just being aware of it is truly like a remarkable thing. And again, like not being sold out by the administration and their empty promises and their empty words and their empty statements. And to Shireen's point, the empty statements that have come out on Islamophobia, I mean, for God's sake, there's a White House strategy on Islamophobia. That is not what we asked for. That is not what we have been committing to. Like you can't even get the word ceasefire out of your mouth, and you're coming out with combating this Islamophobia strategy that in reality is actually only going to increase police surveillance of these communities. Like, we know better than that. And this is not what we're asking for when we say targeting Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian racism. We mean something different. And I think the administration's aware. It's just a matter of how our words can get co-opted and our messaging can go co-opted. So I think just keeping all of that on the radar and continuing to lean in on it is extremely critical.
Iman, Sherry, Shireen, I want to thank you all so much. I realize how busy you've been in this whirlwind of a movement moment. So thank you for the time you've put into this conversation.
Thank you.
Yes, and I'd like to add that for people who are not regular listeners to Victor's Children, you can check out some other recent episodes that might be of interest to you. Episode 36 was on what kind of anti-imperialism with Rama Kudani and Brian Bean. Episode 37 was on Jabra Nicola, Matzpin, and a socialist perspective on Israel-Palestine with Moishe McOver. And episode 31 was on U.S. imperialism today. Episode 33 on Chinese imperialism today. That's it for this episode of Victor's Children. I'd like to thank Jonathan Croker, the producer of Victor's Children, without whom the podcast wouldn't be possible. I'd also like to thank Posey Legg, who designed the graphic for Victor's Children. If you found the episode worth listening to, please do tell other people about the show, since word-of-mouth recommendations are especially helpful. If you don't subscribe through your preferred podcast app, please do. And while you're there, please give the show a high rating. It helps to promote us. If you have a suggestion for an episode or some other kind of constructive feedback, feel free to be in touch with me. You can contact me through victorschildren@gmail.com.